So thanks very much. Thanks to Ben and thanks to the organizers for inviting me. I'm from South Africa, and I've had the privilege to witness the government shutdown in a country in which I've been doing a sabbatical, and it's been a shutdown over the issue of healthcare. It's remarkable. So here's what I see. I see people like screaming from the headlines. It's the end of liberty, the beginning of freedom, etc. But seriously, there is more to this debate than just thinking about more efficient, cost-effective delivery of healthcare. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the South African experience, and perhaps there might be something useful to come out of that. So just as a background, South Africa has a two-tier health system. So we have a heavily laden public health sector, which cares for more than 80% of the population, and we have private health insurance covering about 16% of the population, and they really operate in parallel. And like many private insurance systems, the private healthcare system is facing a crisis because costs are rising and it's seemingly impossible to control. We have fragmented pools. We have about slightly under half of all healthcare expenditure operating through the public sector, and that's where 84% of the population are dependent. About a similar amount goes through medical schemes, which are very heterogeneous, large and small, and they only cover about 16% of the population, and about 13% of expenditures out-of-pocket payments by individuals. So our systems do share something in common. South Africa has this remarkably high proportion of expenditure in the of total healthcare expenditure represented by expenditure within the insurance sector. But what do we have in South Africa? Well, in the private sector, you would expect those middle bars, great inequality and utilization by economic status. So those are quintiles of income. And you can see on the right-hand side, the richest make far better use of private sector. But actually, in the public sector as well, those who are wealthier, who probably are healthier as well, because we know the relationship between health and wealth, are making better use of the public health sector than people who really need it more. So if we look at public and private, the situation is clearly inequitous. And it's particularly in hospital care. So it's regional and the central specialist hospitals that the better off are making use of care, and we know that's the more expensive care, whereas poorer people tend to use primary care services more. So this is the challenge facing South Africa's government, and with a new health minister who has inspired South African healthcare providers by at least putting the denialism of HIV to death, he's basically come out very clearly to support the idea of a national health insurance to promote access to healthcare for all South Africans. So this is from the policy paper, and it states very clearly, healthcare is a right. Our constitution frames a right of access to healthcare in our Bill of Rights. And it goes on to argue that the right should not depend on how rich we are or where we happen to live. Large numbers of people in our country continue to die prematurely and suffer unnecessarily from poor health. And of course, government has tried since 1994 through various policies, but there's still problems, as the government acknowledges, and it says, without a national health insurance, the burden of disease in this country will not be reduced because the majority of the population who have the greatest ill health will not access good quality health care. So I just want to pause there and just make a comment about quality and accessibility. I think in the discussion around universal health care, a lot is made about coverage, and I was at a presentation where a WHO speaker listed countries with different rates of coverage, and Colombia from South America was held up as a flagship of achieving coverage of over 80, almost 90%. But if you talk to people from Colombia, the coverage actually doesn't exist in reality. People are insured, but they're not insured for anything that's useful. And they talk about a journey of death. They describe how poor patients seek healthcare at hospitals and they turned away from one or the other because of these multiple funds. And in practice, they might be covered, you know, in theory, but in practice they don't get access to care. And so we have to be very careful about what do we mean by coverage, and it's coverage for the kind of care that actually makes a difference. So the National Health Insurance in South Africa really has a long background of health reform, and health reform that really places social solidarity as the key issue. In 1928, this was before the apartheid government, there was a report looking at social security, came up with a scheme to cover low-income formal sector employees in urban areas, and in 1936 that extended into a committee of inquiry into the National Health Insurance, and subsequently a commission chaired by the then Secretary for Health, Gluckman, came up with a proposal for a tax-based National Health Insurance. This was at the end of World War II, and it was prefacing the Beveridge Commission in the UK, which introduced the NHS. So there was a lot of interest and a lot of pressure and a lot of modelling of population-oriented primary care in South Africa. Of course, with the ascent of the apartheid government in 1948, those initiatives were quashed. And in fact, many of the thinkers in that movement went elsewhere. Some came to the US, in fact, and were sort of seminal in some changes in thinking around US healthcare systems. And you can see from 1944 to 1994, there's almost nothing. Certainly in civil society, there was thing, but no government commitment to anything resembling equity in healthcare. However, with the democratic elections in 1994, there was then a healthcare finance committee set up within the African National Congress, subsequently a committee of inquiry and various other structures. So there's been a lot of interest initially thinking along the lines of a social health insurance, in other words, a tax payroll-based insurance for people in employment, informal employment, as an incremental step to expanding access. But more recently, the government has focused on the idea of a national health insurance covering all people through a ministerial advisory committee appointed in 2012. And I think what's really important is that the NHI is framed really as a statement of values. And to pick up on what Dabney talks about, the American dream, this is a commitment in saying that it's actually about fairness. So our minister quotes Margaret Chan, talking about this world will never become a fair place by itself. Fairness, especially in matters of health, comes only when equity is an explicit policy objective. Universal coverage is a clear pursuit of equity and social justice. It's a popular equalizer. So South Africa remains a very unequal country. So we have excellent healthcare delivered in some pockets, but we have, you know, all the social determinants of health operating in other directions. And despite some policies aimed at addressing this, we have large numbers of people living in conditions which adversely affect their health. And that's the challenge facing the government, how to balance that. If you look at the burden of disease in South Africa, these are the nine provinces, and the right-hand column is national. You can see quite a lot of variance. And HIV/AIDS playing an important role and very variable across provinces, but for instance, non-communicable disease remains the biggest contributor to the burden of disease in our country and a significant contribution from injury. So many other preventable causes, and that's the health situation facing the state. So the problem, in a sense, is when we think about health, national health insurance, there's a very easy tendency to revert from health to healthcare, because that's much easier to control and the social determinants are upstream, they're multi-sectoral. The minister is sticking to his guns. I wish to take this opportunity to emphasize over and over again that the NHI will be based on a preventive and not a curative healthcare system. I will then repeat in many more occasions to come that primary healthcare, meaning prevention of disease and promotion of health, is going to be the heartbeat of the NHI in South Africa. How the minister is going to achieve that is not entirely clear. But certainly at a rhetorical level and a values level, that's a very clear message, and it's important to understand. So the question is then, how do we think about healthcare being responsive to needs? And the minister comments like this, that the universal healthcare coverage, like any other healthcare system, must be accountable. And it should be responsive to service users rather than profit for shareholders. And Responsiveness is one of the building blocks of health systems, according to the WHO, and it really raises the question of participation. And there's quite a literature on that. The Alma Ata Declaration, for instance, sets out in the 70s, it set out primary health care as being based upon participation in the planning, organization, operation, and control of primary health care. So that's not just community health workers delivering services, it's actually communities or some unit of popular participation being able to contribute to planning, contribute to oversight. Those are very substantive recommendations. Of course, people have poo-pooed Alma Ata as being too pie in the sky, but it's a benchmark we consider, and we see it emerging in the Right to Health and the General Comment 14, in the way it elaborates on the right to health in the covenant. And there is evidence showing that community participation improves effectiveness, improves sustainability of care. It creates more equitable client-provider relationships, so that makes the health system more responsive, builds trust. There's increased ownership of services because people can see that their needs are being addressed. And a systematic review done by researchers at the London School showed that health committees as vehicles for participation can be effective in terms of improving the quality and coverage of healthcare, as well as impacting on health outcomes, especially if located within a set of synergistic health system interventions. So it's really those composite set of interventions that are at the heart of discussing participation in a national health insurance in South Africa. So South Africa has a provision in its National Health Act which sets up health committees. Now, every health facility is meant to have a committee which acts as the interface between communities and that service. It specifies how those committees should be composed, but it doesn't specify at national level what those functions should be. It leaves that decision to the provinces. It's intended to be this interface with a community. But because there's this lack of clarity in the national legislation, there's a gap in which things fall through the cracks. We did an audit in 2012 in our province where it was quite clear that in the absence of a mandate, the committee members are unable to be effective as vehicles for participation. They often lack the skills. They don't know what they're meant to be doing. There's turnover. There's a question of legitimacy in the community. They're not provided with resources. So there's an ambivalent relationship to these structures set up for participation. And it's actually quite contested because in essence, what these committees are meant to do is hold healthcare providers and services accountable, and it's not easy to find healthcare workers who are happy to be held accountable by their patients or clients. So I want to share this experience. When I qualified as a physician and I went to work at a healthcare facility run by a trade union, it was part of a health insurance system within the food sector in South Africa in the 90s. Workers were employed in the food industry and they were low-paid workers who basically couldn't afford private care. So the fund was established as a joint union management structure to pay for fee-for-service provision from private care, private providers. But because of the nature of the market and the way in which it was difficult to control costs, the fund established its own service, in-house service. So it was a kind of non-profit HMO arrangement. But what was particular about this was because it came out of a union, it was based on the principles of worker control. So in fact, even though the formal structure that managed the fund was a joint employer-employee structure, the workers got together in a caucus four times a year before the sort of formal meeting. The fund paid for workers to attend their loss of wages, accommodation, the costs of being in town because these were workers from a very dispersed area. And the workers decided on the benefits of that fund. So we're not talking about a national health insurance, we're talking about a fund in a particular geographical area, but they decided what their money, because it was their money, was be spent on. You know, should it be spent on ocular benefits? If so, what pattern? Who was going to benefit? And the result of bringing workers in to participate meant that the admin overheads for the fund were quite high. They were much higher than the benchmark you would have for what's considered to be efficient fund administration otherwise. But the real benefit was that workers owned that fund. They owned the sense of how that money was going to be spent. And there was a lot of success in cost containment. So workers, in a sense, there was peer pressure not to abuse the benefit, that the moral hazard. And at the same time, it started its own services. It provided services that were not otherwise available in the state sector, promotive, preventive services. It started a stroke clinic for workers who were disabled as a result of having cardiovascular disease. And of course, there's scale-up issues because this is a small sector, but it really provides a model for rethinking about how a pool of money that's shared, that's actually the product of contributions from a large number of people, there's opportunities for those participants to make decisions about how that money is spent. There are other examples in other parts of the world. In Malawi, there was a project by Care International which showed how local communities could sit with clinic providers where there was limited budget to work out a balanced scorecard. And so even when they couldn't provide all kinds of care, there was more participation in deciding what kinds of care would work. In Zimbabwe, despite having a president who has implemented incredibly insane policies in many ways, community health committees in rural areas have been able to successfully effect changes in improving the quality of care by working with providers. In Uganda, there's similar examples. In Latin America, I won't name them. And the really critical issue underlying this is the role of power, because you're asking providers to negotiate away their power in deciding. And as Ben mentioned, we've been working on a project looking at participation. We think the idea of this power cube that was developed by John Gaventa from the Institute for Development Studies is useful in understanding the kinds of power, whether it's visible or invisible, that happens in the healthcare sector, the spaces, whether people are invited into participatory spaces or whether the communities in South Africa will be toy-toying on the streets because the national health insurance doesn't meet their needs, and the levels, so local, national, and in some cases global. And I think it informs how a way we can think about how participation should be structured. So on the left-hand side, there's a formal meeting where workers are participating in a discussion. On the right-hand side, there's a march in the streets. And in South Africa, this is a tricky business because we come out of a tradition with very strong civil society action, very strong political action, but we've moved into an arena where much of this has been professionalized. And here's a quote, actually from the housing sector, not the health sector, but it applies as much. You know, when we were in the struggle, we were heard on the streets. But what I've noticed, to be heard today, you've got to sit with these bastards in the boardroom. Sorry to say it, because we've got boardroom politics now in South Africa. So how does participation become meaningful? There have been experiments in Australia with citizen juries using deliberative democracy processes to think about how healthcare should be prioritized. There have been efforts in Korea to look at using the models developed by Daniels and others about responsibility in healthcare, responsibility for accountability. And we know in Brazil there are very elaborate structures at municipal and regional levels where there's popular participation in deciding on benefits. But here's a quote from Nathan Geffen from Treatment Action Campaign. It's not only the process, it's actually the outcome. So his comment was, we don't want just want a voice, we actually want to win our demands. So a participatory process has to provide a sense that it's actually meaningful, that people's voice will result in changes. So just to conclude, what can we learn, perhaps? Well, I think the rights-based approach to health entails us recognizing that equity is a principle of social justice and has to be part of any health system transformation. Health is more than healthcare, and that's going to be a challenge, thinking through how any system addresses the problem of the social determinants of health. And then community participation is really instrumental to realizing that right to health. I think healthcare reform, therefore, has to elevate equity as a principle, as a value statement, and it's not just about efficiency and effectiveness. We have to address the upstream determinants, and most importantly, I think it has to strengthen the agency of those in the health system who are most vulnerable to ill health. So, I think all things are possible in the national health insurance, but I do think it has to be a single payer, and I'll stop there.
So we've heard three diverse perspectives on what the present and future of human rights and healthcare reform mean. We have just a few minutes left for questions, and so I'm happy to take a couple and have the panelists answer them. Peter.
So those are all very interesting presentations, a lot to think about. I have a question for all panel members, sort of projecting a little bit into the future. I think the first premise that I want to point out is, let's assume the dust settles on the Affordable Care Act, and more or less in the next 6 months gets implemented as planned. Even with its implementation, from this and other information, we know that the Affordable Care Act will leave us far short of having seen as health as human rights. So I think today the answer is human rights, health as human rights, remain more of an aspirational goal than an actual effective goal in the United States. Furthermore, it seems to me that a substantial number of the people who are in the political ruling class, elites, the governance, I'm not too sure that they actually buy in to health as human rights. And I think it's even less sure where the American population stands. Given that state of affairs and potential sources of resistance, I'm interested to know what you would think are the policy or political actions that are feasible that we may be focusing on to move us somewhat more towards the direction of health as human rights.
Okay.
Let's take a couple. I think that'll be helpful given the amount of time we have left. Any others? Any other questions we can pick up before we turn over to our panelists? If not, I will turn it over to our panelists and let them think about these rather confounding issues.
Okay, so my response was the last comment. That was before the discussion about the NHIs and the simple anti-discrimination measures. And the point is, if the playing field is level for all insurance companies, it's easier to do that sort of thing. But if you have, you know, kind of a multiple system where forcing companies to provide care for this, but somebody else can do differently, it'll never work. So I think the role of legislation is quite clear. In other words, it will raise the cost for everyone, but it will be more equitable. And at the end of the day, the question about raised cost is about inefficiency, and that's why I think the single payer is the only real prospect for that, you know, to solve that problem. But you can do it. And South Africa has a set of prescribed minimum benefits. In other words, all insurance has to provide a certain minimum package, and over and above that, you can purchase extra if you want.
Let me address the question that you posed. I know for myself personally, it can be very frustrating whether we're talking about efforts at the state level or the national level. So I think, very simply put, I would say that issues of mobilization and promoting awareness are absolutely essential, and we do a terrible job of that. I'll give you two simple, quick examples. The first has to do with HIV. So I recently approached the governmental relations officer of the Common and AIDS Foundation within my own state and asked them, based on what little I do know about this topical area, and with my own lobbying background as well when I used to work on the Hill, who are the champions of draft bills that you have in the legislature? What connections do you have? What efforts are being done to mobilize that kind of awareness? What are you doing? And he could not articulate a single answer to any of these things. So we're busy making white papers and updating websites and handing out brochures at different events. That's not going to cut it. If you want to actually institute that change at the state level, you need to actually mobilize those forces to actually put that pressure on them. So we can do a much better job of that. On the macro level, certainly the federal level, it might be a surprise, but there are some things we've already done. So the U.S. became a signatory to the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against All Forms of Women back in the early 80s by President Carter. We've had 3 hearings on this ever since then. But it always died in committee at that federal level. And unfortunately, we are that much closer. I ironically was invited to give a talk later this week at a legal symposium as to what happens if we do ratify that convention when it comes to women's health and reproductive rights. So we're only one ratification away in the Senate, but the Foreign Relations Committee has to have that pressure put on them to prioritize that. And again, it falls back on that issue of mobilization and pressure. So I know this is all kind of restricted to that policy and advocacy realm, but I think it speaks very bluntly to the opportunities that are in front of us, and we certainly need to be doing more of that.
So I'll piggyback on that. So the first part of your statement had to do with us in the U.S. Thinking of health as a human right as being something aspirational rather than something that we can actually achieve. And I think that you are, for the most part, right. But I think that there are a lot of places that we can look to where implementation is happening. And so we don't necessarily have to think of the right to health as something that's aspirational. It may be something that's a moving target, and it certainly is an evolution. We think about the concept of things like progressive realization. We think about all rights. It's not a yes or no checkbox kind of right, and it never will be. But we have to continue to, at the same time as we allow it to be aspirational, we have to continue to benchmark ourselves and keep ourselves moving in a positive direction. The other thing that you mentioned was that, you question whether the U.S. public and especially politicians think of health as a right. And in fact, the U.S. stated policy with regard to the right to health, when we report on CERD, which is the rights convention, is in fact the U.S. does not believe that there is such a thing as the right to health. However, here are the things that we do which support the right to health with regards to racial discrimination. So the first thing we have to do is address our own conflicted issue with that, which from the U.S. government perspective is not conflicted. We do not believe that such a thing as the right to health exists. Okay? So that speaks to what Drew is getting at, which is really the advocacy and also what I'm trying to talk about, which is the political will aspect. So we were kind of having this conversation before the panel started, and I was talking about another experience that I had to do with the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and we're essentially the only country in the world that has ratified it at this point. And I was on a panel with a State Department representative, and somebody said, well, how come we haven't ratified it? And he said, well, nobody's beating down the doors of senators to get this on the agenda. All of these things are dying in committee. We have major international human rights covenants that we have not ratified because nobody is forcing our politicians to talk about it. And that's where you guys come in. And I know you've probably been to 10 sessions already today where people are talking about advocacy and things that you have to do, but here's another one for you. And I don't just want to say that in the sense of you are individuals and so you need to get involved and engaged and do more than sit here and listen to this panel, but actually many of us working in public health work for government agencies. I live in Atlanta and work right next to the CDC, and I train many Master of Public Health students that want to work at CDC. Well, guess what? If you work at CDC or you work at a state health department, you are the government. You are the state, okay? So the government, the state, those aren't these things out there, these big, powerful people, right? That's actually us many, many times. So how do these things get onto the agenda? They need to be on your agenda, right? When you are dealing with issues in your own context, especially if you're working within government agencies. So I just want to put that out there. And the other question that I wanted to come back to has to do with the issue that you raised with regards to access. and really this kind of the issue of regulation as being really, really critical in the ACA. And the way that I come at this from a human rights perspective is that protect function, right? So in human rights, we have the obligations of the state, and one of those obligations is not only of the state not to violate the right, but to not allow others to violate it. And so it becomes a role of government then to ensure that the insurance industry is not violating the right to health, as we talk about it and think about it in that way. So regulation is absolutely essential there. And we can also think about, you know, from a rights perspective, we talk a lot of times about the positive and negative sides of rights, which is the things that the government should not do to people, right, and the things that the government should do to kind of facilitate things, another kind of way that people go about these issues. So if you think about a civil and political right, like going to vote, well, not only do you need to, you know, be able to cast your vote, and have a place to go vote and have voting machines and have pollists and poll workers, you also need to have some, if somebody doesn't want to allow you to vote, if there's a group of KKK that say, we're not going to allow African Americans in here to vote, you have a protect function of the government, which is, we're not going to let others, non-state actors, to prevent these people from exercising their rights. The same is true of health, right? So just as there are things that the state doesn't do, there are positive actions that the state must take, and that is also true in the case of health. So sometimes we think of health as being something, as an expensive right, right? Health and education are the expensive right. But we also need the infrastructure and the access, right? We need to have clinics, we need to have doctors, we need to have facilities and goods and services. And so that is part of it as well.
And so I would just add to that, we spent a lot of time talking about federal efforts. I think it is now safe to assume there won't be any more federal laws on healthcare in the foreseeable future. And so a lot of the action on realizing a rights-based approach to health is moving to the states. And I think at this conference, we've seen a number of great examples of state efforts from Vermont to Hawaii that are employing the international framework for human rights to think about how the state can build upon the Affordable Care Act and seek to realize the highest attainable standard of health for all. And so our time is long since expired, so I hope you will join me again in thanking our panelists who came together to think about these issues.